Blog Talk Radio.
Hello and welcome to The Powerful Patient. I'm Joyce Graff and I'm delighted to have you with me today. This is really nice. I'm in Memphis, Tennessee, so it's milder here than it is in snowy Massachusetts. And my guest is actually out in Malibu, California. So we span the U.S. of A today, and glad to have you as part of the mix. I want to start off by telling you that The Powerful Patient is brought to you every week by the VHL Family Alliance. That stands for von Hippel-Lindau disease. And people with VHL fight a series of tumors their whole lives and learn to manage many different medical specialists. So if you are working with more than one medical specialist, or if you have a chronic condition that requires you to follow up on it, I think that you will find some good help here at this program every week. Next week, we're going to talk with Sarah Howell, who grew up with a handicap. And this year, this week, we're talking about a very popular topic that a whole bunch of us worry about, and that is weight control and how best to go about it. You see lots and lots of different advice. There are about three people on every street corner who would like to tell you how to lose weight. But not all of those approaches work. Some of them cost more than others. Some of them take a tremendous amount of your time and energy and don't pay off. And so we're going to talk today with Mark Sissons, who's put a lot of thought and energy and planning into this, and has a very interesting new book called The Primal Blueprint. So we'll come back in a minute and talk with Mark. First, I'd like to play you a little bit of information about our sponsor, about VHL, and we'll be right back in a minute to talk with Mark Sissons.
Von Hippel-Lindau disease, or VHL, is a genetic condition involving abnormal growth of tumors in some parts of the body. VHL occurs in every ethnic group worldwide. At this time, there's no cure, but research is helping those afflicted and their families learn how to manage their disease. When a family member has a tumor, it affects everyone in the family. VHL Alliance works to improve diagnosis, treatment, and the quality of life. Finding tumors early, getting the best treatment, and sharing information with others to help them cope is what VHL Alliance is all about. They're available to help lessen the stress of living with this lifetime chronic disease. Support the Cancer Research Fund of the VHL Alliance at VHL.org. That's Very Happy Life, VHL.org. 1-800-767-4-VHL.
Hi there. And at this point, I'd like to introduce our guest. Hi, Mark.
Hi, Joyce. How are you?
Good. This is Mark Sissons, the author of Primal Blueprint. So, Mark, tell us a little bit about your book and about how you got interested in the topic of weight loss.
Well, it goes back to my youth. I was always interested in health and fitness. I became a runner. I was an endurance athlete throughout my teen years and early 20s and became actually one of the top marathoners in the country. Finished fifth in the U.S. National Championships in 1980. I was doing all the right things. I was running, which is what I was told by people like Ken Cooper and the medical community was the best thing you could do for your heart and to keep the weight off. I was eating a very complex high-carbohydrate diet because that's what you needed to do to fuel that amount of exercise. I was, by most measures, one of the fittest people on the planet. But inside, I was falling apart. I had chronic tendonitis in my hips. I had osteoarthritis in my feet. I had irritable bowel syndrome, chronic upper respiratory tract infections. You name it, and I was basically trashing my immune system, and I was trashing my joints. And all in the name, I thought, of pursuing health. So I had to retire at an early age, and I wound up looking at all of the mistakes I'd made and all the mistakes other people make when they think they are doing the right thing with regard to health. I have a degree in biology from Williams College, and I was a pre-med candidate, so I'd always had a real strong interest in how the body works and in human performance. And so in the mid-80s, I started researching all of the things that we can do to improve health using the latest scientific advances. And as my research continued and I saw how people were trying to lose weight but were unsuccessful, even though they were struggling and suffering and sacrificing and cutting calories and portion control and all those things, and I saw people failing at their attempts to get stronger and fitter in the gym a little bit. You know, they'd get a little bit of results, but not the kind of results that would justify the amount, the high amount of energy and effort, sweat, sacrifice that went into these. I started to look at, in almost a selfish way, how can I get the best possible results with the least amount of suffering and sacrifice and pain, with the most amount of enjoyment, pleasure, ease, grace? How can I do this for myself, and how can other people learn to lose weight effortlessly, keep it off, have more energy, get sick less often? And as I was doing my research, I started to look into this brand new emerging science of genetics. The Human Genome Project was starting to really take shape. And we were starting to see that a lot of what happens in the body happens at the level of gene expression. And you, more than anyone that I ever interview with, Joyce, know what I'm talking about. Genes control what's going on in the cell, in every cell of our body, every minute of every day. And it's really how these genes turn on or off that manifests itself in whether we get strong or weak, whether we get sick or stay well, whether we have a lot of energy or no energy, whether we store fat for the rest of our lives or burn it for the rest of our lives. It's all about finding the genes that control these different aspects of our metabolism and then sending them the right signals so that the right genes turn on and we turn off the genes that we want to turn off. So my book, The Primal Blueprint, is a analysis of human evolution, 2 million years of human evolution. That's the primal part. And it combines modern genetic science, that's the blueprint part, with evolutionary biology to arrive at some pretty simple rules for living, eating, exercising, and so on, that can help us redirect, and I use the term reprogram our genes, so that we burn off fat, so that we maintain a healthy body weight effortlessly, so that we sleep better, that we have, that our mood improves, that we have more energy, that we don't get sick as often, and quite possibly that we live longer by reducing our risk for a whole host of degenerative diseases that all sort of depend on lifestyle and which genes get turned on or off.
Right. That brings up so many different topics that I'd love to pursue with you. Let me start with the immune system. You mentioned that even though you were one of the fittest people by normal measures, your immune system had been eroded.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of people, you know, the science will show you that exercise is good for supporting the immune system.
Up to a certain point, though.
What the science does not show, that's exactly right. What the science does not show is that when people exercise too much, it has an adverse effect on the immune system. It's exercise is a form of stress, and up to a certain degree, it's a positive stress, and it's good for you. But beyond that, there's a neuroendocrine response to what the body perceives as a life-threatening situation, and cortisol is released from the adrenal glands, and it suppresses the immune system, among other things. It tears down muscle tissue. It decreases the uptake of calcium by bones. It shuts down reproduction, so people can't conceive when they're under a lot of stress. There are a lot of things that happen as a result of this adrenal hormone, cortisol, and when we exercise too much, as I was doing, we are in a chronic state of cortisol secretion, which, among many other negative consequences, a suppressed immune system is one. Now, another thing that happens as a result of trying to do the right thing and listening to conventional wisdom, was this adherence to a high carbohydrate diet in order to fuel the exercise I was doing. And of course, at the time, this fear of fat was driving most of the medical community and the health community. So, you know, you have three types of macronutrients you can choose from for your food: protein, fat, and carbohydrate. Protein's fairly limited. If you cut the fat out because of your fear of fat, and you need the calories to continue racing or exercising or doing whatever you're doing, you have to increase the amount of carbohydrate. And carbohydrate, for the most part, grains in particular, turn into glucose almost immediately in the bloodstream. That raises insulin, which is not a good thing, because insulin is a fat storage hormone, and sugar is one of the most powerful immune suppressors we know of. So between the high complex carbohydrate diet and all of the so-called healthy foods I was eating that converted to sugar as soon as it hit my gut, and the excess amount of exercise, instead of supporting my immune system being healthy, I was sick all the time. Colds and flu and you know, irritating little cuts and whatever that wouldn't heal. It was crazy. But that's when you dig down, when you drill into the research, you understand that that's what's going on. And it was going on with me, and it's going on with tens of millions of people.
One of the observations that we made in the VHL community was that sometimes, even though the children in a family all who have VHL all have exactly the same copy of the VHL gene, so this particular genetic factor that's wrong is wrong in the same way in each of those siblings, and yet the person with the lousiest trip in that family was often the exercise nut. You know, the one who one would think would be the healthiest,
you know, and again,
turn out to have the worst consequences.
It's a perfect example of, you know, kind of assuming that since exercise is good for you, a lot of exercise must be really good for you. And, you know, again, you're identifying exactly what I talk about, which is this whole concept of gene expression. You can have that VHL gene SNP, that single nucleotide polymorphism, and it doesn't necessarily mean it's going to manifest exactly the same in everyone who carries it, because it is turned on or off by a whole host of other signals, some of which involve other genes, some of which involve immediate surroundings like the air you breathe, the food you eat, and the types of exercise you do. And you could say, well, wait a minute, how is it that exercise could possibly have an effect on gene expression? Well, the exercise creates metabolic byproducts. It may be lactic acid. It may be an increase in CO2. It may be this increase in cortisol as a result of doing too much exercise. Those may be the actual chemical signals that then go in and, you know, somehow manifest themselves in gene expression one way or the other. And so the very interesting that you identify that the people who are most affected might be the ones who are exercising so much. And
the
it may
over,
be that...
The over-exercise.
Exactly.
The other thing
don't get me
wrong.
Don't get me wrong. I mean, I'm a big, huge fan of exercise.
Right.
But I coined a phrase a few years ago called chronic cardio. And it deals with these millions of people who go to the gym every day or out on the roads, and they're, you know, running their little hearts off, literally, 80 to 90% of their max heart rate for 45 minutes, or watching that little LED readout on the treadmill climb up to 500 or 600 calories. And that's okay to do once in a while, but to do it as a regular, continuous daily regimen is probably antithetical to health. Better that you go for long, easy walks, keep the heart rate down, because humans evolved to be very frequent movers at a slow pace. We're very efficient fat burners when we're walking. You know, our ancestors migrated, crawled, foraged, hunted, gathered. They didn't do a lot of going out and racing 20 miles.
Right, but we used to walk 2 miles to the nearest neighbor or a mile and a half to the schoolhouse or the church. And so we did get a lot more walking.
Even as recently as 50 years ago,
Even the equivalent of 2 or 3 blocks just to go down to the creek to fetch water. So there used to be a lot more walking built into our days than there is now.
Absolutely, and that's my point. So if we go back and look at how we walked not just 50 years ago, but 2 million for 2 million years.
Right.
We did a lot of walking.
Right,
seems like our genes are expecting us to walk now, and when we do that, it's not about, by the way, it's not about burning calories. People say, well, I would walk, except it doesn't burn many calories. It's not about the burning the calories. It's about the movement of the body, which has other positive gene expression outcomes.
Uh-huh, that's interesting. The other thing I was thinking, though, is that if we look back at the way we evolved, for one of us to run 26 miles or something, it was probably a state of warfare or, you know, imminent danger, like that saber-toothed tiger is after you, and if you stop, you're lunch. So, and so it probably is your body's programming to say, that overexercise means there's danger around me and I need to shut down certain systems, like you better not get pregnant, there's no time for that, or, you know, other things that you were mentioning that the body just decides are not appropriate for this time.
Correct. There's a fantastic book written probably, I don't know, 15 years ago by a professor at Stanford by the name of Robert Sapolsky, and it's called Why Zebras Don't Get Ulcers. And it's a book that deals with the evolution of this whole stress response system and how the adrenal glands kick in, and in animals who aren't worrying about the mortgage payment or traffic or the noisy neighbors, it works perfectly for them. But in our modern society, we overuse our adrenals, not just in exercise, but in just stress in general.
Mm-hmm.
And the ironic part about that is people who have a chronic disease are already stressed from the physical manifestation of the disease, and then the added stress, which is very difficult to overcome sometimes, comes
mm-hmm.
from just thinking about what they're having to deal with. And all of these
right.
are very relevant to how our body handles stress and the ways in which we can identify to maybe reduce the stress.
Right.
And I talk about this a bit in my book, in the Primal Blueprint, that it isn't just, I mean, exercise is a great stress release, and I highly encourage people to walk. I also encourage people to run sprints, but, you know, 6 or 8 of them for 10 to 15 seconds once a week, because that's kind of emulating what our ancestors did. You said that, you know, to get away from a saber-toothed tiger, yeah, it was a quick sprint or else it didn't work, you know, or else you failed because you got eaten. So there are... our genes expect that, a very high, intense output. And it doesn't have to be running. It can be on a stationary bike. It could be on an elliptical trainer, whatever, just a high output for very short, brief periods of time. These wind up manifesting themselves in better cardiovascular conditioning than, say, going out and slogging out 40 minutes to an hour, 5 days a week, of that kind of monotonous, you know, jogging kind of thing.
Right. There's a whole new field called psychoneuroimmunology that
right.
deals with the psychological stressors and how those interact with our immune systems as well.
And they're very significant. I'm a big follower of that whole movement. Have you read Bruce Lipton's The Biology of Belief?
I haven't, no.
Highly recommend it. He talks about this. And again, it's about literally about manifesting gene expression through you know, thoughts you think and thought patterns, and it's not an airy fairy manifestation or anything at all. It's very, very scientifically based. And in fact, the guy taught med school for a number of years and was you know, just sort of left to pursue this one field. So absolutely, it's within our power to control the stress. Although it's easier said than done, isn't it?
Yes, for sure. Now, you mentioned you wanted to make weight loss painless, fun, and easy. That sounds like a wonderful thing to do, but the trendy program that's on the television right now is this Biggest Loser program. And so what do you think of that kind of an approach, the sort of macro physical,
yeah.
get out there and run a marathon, and, you know, even if you're 200 pounds overweight, your goal should be to run a marathon?
I think it's one of the most egregious misrepresentations of where the science is in weight loss. I think it's an abomination. Stop me when you've heard enough. I think it's a ridiculous, you know, it's a circus act. It's a parlor trick. It's a this show is just for entertainment only. And I bet there are millions of people who, after seeing the sweating and the groaning and the grunting and the crying and the throwing up and all of the stuff they do and the yelling and the berating and the guilt that, some of these contestants feel, you know, just kind of go, what's the point? I'm not willing to work that hard. That does not sound like anything that I could, that I would want to do, even if I could do it.
Just the very thought of it makes them want a Twinkie.
Exactly. I think it turns a lot of people off. You know, I would.
No, it's like the people who try to berate you into quitting smoking. It just makes people want to smoke.
Right.
So you've got to. Because for many people, food is one of the ways that they use to manage their stress.
Yes.
So if you increase their stress, sometimes you just increase their desire for this inappropriate stress management tool that they've gotten into.
I mean, the science is so wrong in what they're doing, starting with the fact that they have these people sometimes try to burn off 6,000 calories a day, completely inappropriate. It's tearing down muscle. Dehydrating them. It's doing a lot of things that show short-term impressive weight loss, but it's not really positively impacting their health. It's not, it's not leading to any long-term lifetime strategy. In fact, many of these people gain the weight back within a few years. There are sites that are dedicated to, you know, sort of where are they now, and some of these people, I think the first year's winner gained back almost all of his weight. How is that how can that possibly be healthy? What I'm trying to promote is a lifestyle that doesn't just end after 30 days or 60 days, but is one that people can embrace and go, wow, this is really cool. I love the food I'm eating. I don't have to count calories. I don't have to measure and weigh and portion control. I can eat as much as I want from this list as long as I don't eat anything from that list. Mm-hmm. I can eat whenever I want. And I know that I can live this way for the rest of my life. It's very empowering, this primal blueprint way of eating. And it's really based on the hunter-gatherer diet of 2 million years of human evolution. So, yes, it's based on vegetables at the base of the pyramid, and lots of meat, fish, fowl, and eggs as source of protein, nuts, seeds, spices, herbs, all the things you want to make your food tasty. What it does not include are sugars, oils like the trans fats and the hydrogenated oils. There are a lot of fat in the healthy side of this, but we avoid some of the unhealthy fats. And then we've eliminated grains, and that's what that means is no bread, cereal, pasta, rice, that sort of thing, because what we've really concluded is that there is no good reason, with all the other good foods out there, there's no reason to make grains any significant part of your diet other than as a very cheap source of calories that converts to sugar pretty quickly in your body.
Mm-hmm.
And grains contain a lot of things that we call anti-nutrients, which are things to which the human digestive tract never really adapted or evolved to handle. Gluten is certainly the most common one that people know of. You've heard of gluten intolerance.
Right.
And people are trying to avoid gluten. That's because gluten is a protein that can have some pretty devastating effects. If you're a celiac patient, you can't eat wheat or anything with gluten in it, or you will literally be starting to destroy your intestines. But there are other...
That's because of a particular chemical imbalance. That's for people.
Correct, but it's just much more highly manifested in people that have celiac disease, but my thesis is that doesn't mean that same chemical, that gluten or gliadin, that same thing isn't happening in all of us, just to a lesser extent, to where it may not even be symptomatic.
Of people who have cardiac issues have been told to reduce cholesterol and things like that, and you see all these ads on TV, I reduce my cholesterol by adding grains and going to whole grains. And so help us with the pros and cons of whole grains.
Well, the first thing we have to understand is that your cholesterol levels per se, your absolute total cholesterol levels, have little, if anything, to do with heart disease. HDL cholesterol, the high-density lipoprotein, the more you have, the better. That's a given, and all scientists will argue, will agree with that.
Mm-hmm.
Of the LDL, which everyone assumes the entire family of LDL cholesterol is a bad thing, and you want to keep that number as low as possible. In fact, there's only a small subfraction of LDL that would be considered risky in terms of heart disease, and it's what we call small, dense LDL particles. Most of the LDL cholesterol is actually quite healthy and beneficial and is serving a very important purpose throughout the body. So it just boggles my mind that the medical community continues, in the face of all of this new evidence, this amazing new, they're starting to pinpoint the proximate causes of heart disease, that physicians still seem to glom onto this notion that we must lower your cholesterol at all costs, and whether that's through prescribing statin drugs, which have been shown to have little to zero impact on overall mortality in most of the people who take the statin drugs.
Mm-hmm.
And then it gets down to this bizarre notion that maybe by taking some whole wheat, that the fiber in the, or whole grains, that the fiber in the whole grains will somehow remove some of the cholesterol and lower the cholesterol numbers,
mm-hmm.
and therefore improve your chances of living longer and not having heart disease. In fact, there's no science that shows that lowering cholesterol through increasing fiber, again, affects any form of mortality or even
right.
cardiac
and
outcomes.
What you're referring to, and just want to make sure everybody's on the same page with you, is that there are statistics that will show that in many cases the drugs or the diet can change the numbers. That's clear. But did the numbers really affect the lifespan of this individual? And there is not any significant data on that.
Well, there's significant data. It just doesn't. It's just not.
It doesn't indicate
that lowering cholesterol in that manner has any outcome on mortality. In fact, what they do show, the one thing that is clear is that the lower your cholesterol is, the greater your increase in mortality, risk for mortality in all other causes besides heart disease.
Really?
Absolutely. And we talk about that in my book, and there are a number of books that will talk about that, but that's one of the things that you don't hear, that
cancer
between...
Cancer and other diseases.
If other increase in cancer, increase in suicides and violent deaths, all sorts of other things that happen, because cholesterol is one of the most important molecules in the body. You can't live without it. It's an integral part of every cell membrane. A lot of your hormones use cholesterol as a primary raw material. So a body makes, 1,200 to 1,300 milligrams a day of cholesterol by itself on its own, regardless of how much you include in your diet. So there has been no research that shows that there is a correlation with increased cholesterol intake in the diet and an increase in death or mortality. Yeah, they'll show the numbers that maybe there's an increase in LDL cholesterol, but when they don't break out the difference between the harmful small dense LDL and the beneficial large fluffy, what we call large fluffy LDL, then you don't have any data. It's a ridiculous kind of continued pattern where they're looking to show that cholesterol is a proximate cause of heart disease when it is not. So anyway, long-winded explanation, but getting back to the whole idea of whole grains, there is no reason. I mean, if you think that fiber, is a reason to be consuming whole grain, it's not. The fiber in most whole grains, is not necessary. The body doesn't need as much fiber as people think that you do, and you get plenty from the vegetables and fruits that you eat if you eat even a reasonably healthy primal or paleo type diet. Mm-hmm. You don't need any of this supplemental fiber at all. And in fact, people who are taking a lot of supplemental fiber may be doing themselves a huge disservice, particularly things like psyllium husk and the like, and some of the trade names that use psyllium husk as its primary ingredient, because it expands in the intestines, and the intestinal wall is not a muscle that is intended to be, you know, stretched. When you stretch that, the intestinal wall, you weaken it, and when you weaken it, you leave it open to digestive issues and pocketing and diverticuli and other things. So there's a whole body of work now that looks at maybe we take in too much fiber.
That's interesting. One of the things you mentioned before is that you not only reduce the bad oils, but you increase the sources of the good oils. And I think oil in general has gotten a bad rap for the last 50 years. We've been told to avoid oils. You don't need those fats and so forth. And yet there are certain kinds of fats that our bodies really do need.
Yeah, I pretty much avoid oils other than olive oil, but I do increase the amount of fats. I have zero concern about saturated fat. I think people's avoidance of saturated fat is another thing that's causing a lot more illness than it's preventing. I think saturated fat is a very important part of the diet, and so I embrace the saturated fat that I'll find in all of the animal products that I eat, I eat a lot of avocado, which is a source of monounsaturated fat. I do put some olive oil on my dressings, but I have macadamia nuts every day. My diet is probably 60 to 65% fat in terms of the caloric breakdown and caloric percentage. But my body fat is about 8%. I'm 56, soon to be 57 years old. I've maintained 8% body fat on this high-fat, low-carb diet for, 20 years. And when I say effortlessly, because if you read my book, you'll see that I don't require people to train that much. Walk as much as you want, sprint a couple times a week, and then go to the gym, or sprint once a week, excuse me, go to the gym a couple of times a week, not an hour a day, but maybe 2 days a week, and go and do an intense 25 to 30 minute full body workout, and you will be healthy and fit. And we show in the book the types of exercises that, again, manifest themselves in a what we call a functional fitness that looks great, avoids injury, allows you to be able to go out and play, because play is one of my 10 laws. You have to find time in your life to play. It's certainly one of the stress relievers. But, I do stand-up paddling on a surfboard. I surf. I snowboard. So I can go. I'm fit enough that I can go snowboarding 5 days in a row and have a great time and not get injured and not get sore.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, I'll get sore. I'll grant you that. But, and I can play a heated game of Ultimate Frisbee once a week with my son and his teenage friends, and I can still out-sprint some of them. I like to play. And so, but I don't call play work. I don't call it training. When I play, I'm having fun. I'm out there to have fun primarily.
Not trying to work a particular muscle group, just out there to have fun.
Right. So my training then works these, it's brief periods of full body range of motion type things, push-ups, pull-ups, mm-hmm. dips, human movement that, mm-hmm. Our ancestors, basic human movement, push, pull, squat, lunge, twist, pretty simple movements, but we tend to get caught up in this $4,000 piece of equipment that isolates our biceps or, that isolates our calves in the gym, and we forget that, if we're not a bodybuilder, it ain't about building one muscle at a time. It's about functional fitness and having the fitness to be able to go out and run for 45 minutes if you feel like it, just not every day.
Okay. But it's also, as you say, the functional fitness, just being able to get in and out of a chair or in and out of the car.
Or lift your grandchildren up or carry a suitcase through an airport.
Right.
Or put a box on a shelf without hurting your back. Yeah, absolutely.
And you do what you need to do in the course of the day.
Right.
You mentioned that you were having problems. As fit as you were having problems with tendonitis and IBS. Can you tell us a little bit about that and what you felt were the things that aggravated it and how you managed to heal it?
Sure. With regard to the IBS, it was quite clear. My whole life, I don't think I ever handled stress that well. So I was always a fairly, you know, type A kind of stressful guy. And I had pretty bad IBS from the age of about 14 until about the age of 47.
Wow. And
I thought it was part of my life.
This is irritable bowel syndrome.
Yes, irritable bowel syndrome. So there would be times when if I weren't near a bathroom, I would panic because I knew something was about to happen.
Mm.
And I would wake up most mornings of my life, even on a good day, with, you know, the urge being the first thing that hit me in the morning and a slight pain that would only be alleviated with that.
Mm.
And I assumed that that was just who I was and my stress levels and whatever. When I gave up the grains, and I only gave up the grains reluctantly because understand that I was a 40-year grain junkie. I lived on grains. I fueled my high-intensity aerobic and endurance training with, I was trying to do the right thing, a healthy, you know, whole grain pasta, whole grain cereal, muesli, granola, whole grain breads for sandwiches, whole grain rolls, you name it, and I was incorporating it as part of 1,000 grams a day of carbohydrate from mostly from grains. And I never really thought anything of it. And I started doing my research, and I was reading about how bad grains are. And I thought, well, it's just maybe for some people, but not for me. I just don't see that. And I kept eating my grains, and I kept living my life, and I kept incorporating other aspects of my primal blueprint, cutting back on my training. I was getting great results there. I was doing a bunch of other, I was trying to improve my sleep habits. I was getting more sun because that's one of my primal rules. But finally, I'd read enough about grains and how devastating they can be that I thought, well, you know, I'm in this business. I'm an experiment of one. I'll give them up for a month. Well, within a month, my irritable bowel syndrome went away forever. My arthritis that I had in my fingers that I just thought whenever I played golf or did something that required gripping, I just thought, you know what, that's just, I'm in my late 40s. That's a normal part of life. Arthritis is what it is. That went away.
Huh.
The benign prostatic hyperplasia, that urge to get up in the middle of the night and pee that men have when they're my age, gone.
Hmm.
So it was very clear to me that, and I'm my best example, that you can assume that grains, I'm somebody, since I don't have celiac, I'm okay with grains. And it isn't until you actually experiment and get rid of them and start to notice the difference in your, and now what happens, now if I do, because every once in a while I'm tempted, you know, by a nice piece of bread at a restaurant or something, I notice the effect on me, and I don't like it. So I've become quite clear that it's the grains that were causing a lot of that, those problems that I had, probably including the arthritis. Now, the arthritis was, you know, part of the arthritis was just pounding the pavement 100 miles a week.
Right, but there's also foods that can promote inflammation or reduce inflammation. So is it all about grains, or was there something else that you found was party to the inflammation?
Well, back to the original premise, which was that inflammation is a, there are genes
right.
in the body that literally promote inflammation.
Right.
And what are the signals that turn those genes on? They may be an acute injury, maybe pounding as happens with, or overuse of a muscle as happens with a repetitive motion like marathoning. Mm-hmm. But it may also be trans fats or omega-3 fats. You know, in a lot of diets today, we hear about omega-6. And in today's world, we hear about the balance between omega-6 fats and omega-3 fats. Omega-3 fats are good for us, and they are polyunsaturated fats that literally turn the inflammation gene down or off. And omega-6 are pro-inflammatory.
Hmm.
So if you have a much higher intake of omega-6, a lot of which are found in grains, a lot of which are found in these oils, these seed oils or corn oil, safflower oil, canola oil, et cetera, et cetera.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So when you alter the ratio of omega-3 to omega-6, you alter the gene expression and turn the inflammation either down or up. And in my case, once I increased the amount of omega-3s in my diet and cut the grains and cut the sugar, because sugar and grains in general raise insulin, and insulin is pro-inflammatory, the arthritis goes away. It's just it's pretty remarkable, and I was a pretty good lab experiment because I was doing everything at such a high level.
Well, now tell me, because you said you were a bit of a grain junkie, so how do you wean yourself off of grains? If you've always enjoyed grains and they've been the backbone of your diet, how do you wean yourself down from that?
The first thing you have to sort of get your mind around is the idea that grains by themselves are pretty nasty. How many people order a plain bowl of spaghetti or a plain piece of toast with nothing on it because they love that taste, you know, or a plain saltine without the salt? The idea that you would choose these foods in that form over, say, lamb chop, pork chop, egg, grilled vegetables is kind of ridiculous. And so when we realize that the only way we can eat our grains is, well, waffles with maple syrup or whipped cream and strawberries, spaghetti with marinara or pesto sauce or some great sauce, bread, it's just a vehicle to hold the meat and lettuce and tomatoes within so they don't fall on the floor, because otherwise, mm-hmm. you know. So when you start to recognize that I could have all those, I could just eat a bowl of marinara sauce, I could just have what's inside the sandwich, I could just have the whipped cream and strawberries and be better off than eating that 60 grams of carbohydrate that's right now is just the vehicle for carrying all this other stuff in. You know, truth is, I mean, I do, if I walk past a Cinnabon place in the airport, I start to salivate for sure. But, you know, between the yeast and the cinnamon and the sugar, it's really not about the grains.
Mm-hmm.
And that's point number one. Point number two is when you start to cut back on this and you realize that if I'm going to make the transition into eating off of the list of primal foods, I better stock my house with primal foods. So if I ever get hungry or ever get a hankering for a bagel at the middle of the day or a honey bun or a you know, whatever you might eat, that I've got an alternative.
Mm-hmm.
Could be a cold chicken leg, it could be a handful of macadamia nuts or walnuts, something that I can nosh on, that I can snack on, that'll take the edge off my hunger and eventually over a couple of, literally it takes about 3 weeks to reprogram your genes, you lose that craving. And, you know, you can ruin it by going to a party and somebody says, hey, have a giant slice of cake. But as you start to eat lower and lower carb, all of a sudden the effects of the occasional indulgence are very noticeable. You know, then you start to see what happens. The insulin goes up, the heart rate starts racing, you start sweating and get jittery because now you're really at the effect of all of the sugar in your system. And until you started to eat clean, the same thing was going on in your body, the same sort of dangerous, poisonous levels of sugar, but you just didn't realize it because you were accustomed to it on a regular basis, and your body, which doesn't like pain, says, we better turn down the sensors on this guy. If he's going to start eating like this all the time, we better just not notice it. So the beauty of eating cleanly is after a while, you really, if you do go off the wagon and you do have a bad session where you eat the wrong kind of stuff, you do notice it, and then your brain, and then you can consciously go, aha, I don't want to do that again.
Right. So you can see more clearly the effects of that piece of cake, and you can go, hey, was it really worth it?
Was it worth the 3 minutes? The 3 minutes maximum that it took to scarf it down? You know, it's like it's weird. If you do the analysis and you go, okay, I mean, if I'm going to have a piece of pie or a piece of cake or, you know, whatever, I'm going to have this short-term gustatory sensation, this pleasurable, you know, mildly pleasurable experience for 2 or 3 minutes, but then I won't sleep all night. I'll be tossing and turning in bed. I'll have heartburn. You know, however it's going to manifest itself, and you start to realize it's just not worth it. Okay, I'll have a bite. I'll have one bite. I'll get the taste sensation of it. Yep, got it. Thanks. Move on, you know?
Interesting. So you do allow yourself a bite or two now and then just to give yourself, as you say, that
totally.
Delicious.
If I'm out at a restaurant with friends, I'll have two bites of a rich, you know, chocolatey dessert. I'll have a bite of pie or whatever. I just, you know, I know my limitations. And I'm okay with having one bite. You know, it's like, at what point are 75 bites better than 2 bites? You know, once you got the taste sensation, it's, you know, it's all just about. Then it becomes back to your concept.
Longer.
Yeah.
Chew it longer, keep it in your mouth, enjoy it longer. But but then you don't have all the bulk in your gut for the next 12 to 24 hours.
Right.
You mentioned about sugar being a hard on the immune system. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of research that shows that sugar is an immune suppressor. And one of the many ways it happens is by just increasing this stress response, because sugar that cannot be cleared from the bloodstream is toxic to the body. Sugar is used as fuel, but it is toxic to the body, and that's how type 2 diabetics get in such trouble, and how the whole concept of losing your vision or having amputation happens as a result of this dangerously high levels of sugar that cannot be cleared, because the insulin, which is supposed to clear the sugar, can't talk to the cells. They've become resistant to the cells. So one of the ways in which sugar suppresses the immune system is simply by its presence in the bloodstream. Another way is in that vitamin C, which is integral to the immune system, uses the same access pathways to get inside the cell that sugar does. And so when you have a lot of sugar in your system, it occupies the sites that are trying to gain entrance to the cells. Even though it may not get in the cell, it can occupy the sites and prevent the vitamin C from getting inside the cell.
It essentially blocks the vitamin C from getting
in.
Interesting.
Right. So it's a, you know, it's. I mean, to the extent that I've even had my own experiences of that, where I've, gone in my youth when I went on a sugar binge, and then noticed within 2 days I've got a cold or something, because exactly what had happened. I mean, I'd so compromised my immune system. Because don't forget, our immune systems are working on our behalf 24/7 all the time.
Yes.
And when our immune system works well, you know, we're always in contact with viruses and microbes and fungi and germs and all manner. And it's our immune system that's always keeping. Otherwise, you'd be sick all the time.
Right.
So it only takes a little bit of a lapse in the security of the immune system to let one of these little things take hold and have to run its course.
There's also some research that seems to indicate that our immune systems are being weakened by the constant pummeling they're taking from things like the pollutants in the air and the insecticides and everything else that we're being exposed to now, more so than before.
Totally agree. Absolutely. That's why it makes, you know, makes sense. Well, I'll give you another example. We spend so much time indoors, partly because we're told to avoid the sun. The sun causes cancer. You know, I tie 40 pages in my book dedicated just to describing and you know how we evolved to require sunlight to make vitamin D, and how vitamin D is one of the most integral vitamins involved in the immune system. So when you don't have enough vitamin D, your immune system doesn't work. And people stay out of the sun because they think it's going to give them skin cancer. And in fact, I would argue that far more cancers happen as a result of staying out of the sun and not getting enough vitamin D, then are prevented by staying out of the sun.
You know, they've done some research lately that, especially in postmenopausal women, vitamin D deficiency is rampant. That
almost
all older women are low on vitamin D.
Right, and for a lot of reasons, but not the least among which is their avoidance of you know, of sunlight, because they're trying to maintain their youthful skin, or they've been told by their dermatologist that because they're you know, perimenopausal or postmenopausal, that now they're even in greater danger of keratoses or little, you know, skin issues, and so they stay out of the sun and they get no vitamin D. And then they wonder why they have osteoporosis. They say, well, I'm taking 3,000 milligrams of calcium a day.
Right.
Well, the calcium needs the vitamin D to get into the bones. And the calcium also needs boron and magnesium and other cofactors, but the primary thing that the calcium needs to get into the bones is exercise, is weight-bearing exercise. So the best thing a postmenopausal woman could do is go to the gym. Actually, the best thing she could do is go outside and then lift weights outside in the sun. But aside from that, go to the gym and lift some heavy weights to give the give the bones a reason to need to take the calcium in.
Or just walk around the block for all that.
Yeah, well, that's walking around the block is good, but that's not the type of exercise that causes an increase in bone density, because it's really the weight bearing activity. It's literally the things like, you know, doing a couple of squats with some, you know, you don't even have to have weights on. Just do a couple of squats or some pull ups or some push ups or some stuff that puts a little bit more tension on the muscles, which then, because the muscles attach to the bone, and it's that. When the muscles literally pull on their attachment of the bone, it's what prompts the bone, which it's what prompts the genes in the osteoclast or osteocytes in the bone to want to build more bone muscle or bone mass.
Right. They've been doing exercise classes with senior citizens where even sitting on a chair and doing certain kinds of things with a small weight, even just a can of vegetables will do it, but a one-pound weight. And doing certain exercises has all kinds of positive benefits on mood as well as physical strength.
Probably, again, you know, they say 300% increases in strength. They'll take literally invalid seniors and make them mobile again just by doing a little bit of this focused weight training.
Amazing. This is really great. Thank you, Mark. Tell me now, you have a website, marksdailyapple.com. Tell us about what you do at Mark's Daily Apple.
So at Mark's Daily Apple, we talk about all things related to health, fitness, medicine, diet. We post an interesting, often humorous, always informative article once a day. Have done so for 3.5 years. It has become one of the top health and fitness sites on the internet. We did about 300,000 unique visitors last month. We've built a huge community of people who are sharing their experiences with the Primal Blueprint, the book, with taking on the diet and the exercise regimen and the other aspects of the lifestyle. So we have hundreds, if not thousands, of testimonials on the site about their experience with how wonderful it was to realize that they could not only lose 30 pounds in 2 months, but they feel like 100 pounds have been lifted off their shoulders because they know they can live like this the rest of their lives. And that's really the reason I did the book, was because I had so much great information and feedback from having done the website for 3.5 years. So, and we sell the book is available on the site. Primal Blueprint is available on marksdailyapple.com. It's also available on Amazon and in Barnes & Noble. And then the book is also we have a site called primalblueprint.com for people who want to just look and find out a little bit more about the book before they buy.
Great. Well, thank you so much. And you'll be able to get all these websites from the handout at powerfulpatient.org. And this interview with Mark will be available as a podcast or just on demand from powerfulpatient.org. So we hope that you have enjoyed this hour with Joyce and Mark, and we hope that you will get his book and some advice here. It sounds like a really good plan, not just for taking off 30 pounds for the wedding or whatever you have it in a, as a goal in mind, but really making changes that you can live with for your whole life and try to learn how to manage your weight on an ongoing basis and not just go up and down for particular occasions. So next week we're going to talk with Sarah Howell, who grew up with a handicap, and her horse helped her very much in growing up with her handicap. So you'll get to talk with Sarah. She's a really interesting young woman, and I hope that you will have a great week between now and then. Be well and be a powerful patient. Take good care, and we'll see you soon. Bye.